Hello and welcome to More or Less, the programme which tests numerical claims to their limits. I'm Tim Harford. I always said statistical accuracy was the new rock and roll, and today I'm proving that as I speak to you from under a duvet in my bedroom. When I started calling myself the undercover economist 15 years ago, I didn't think it would end up being quite such a literal sobriquet, but these are the times we live in. I'm not sure what Radio 4 originally had in mind for this slot, but somehow they decided that our trademark combination of unashamed nerdiness and, you know, facts might go down rather well instead. So here we are with a coronavirus special, and it's an honour to be broadcasting to the nation. Statistical National Treasure Professor Sir David Spiegelhalter is going to help us put the risks of COVID-19 into perspective. We'll try to understand what the ever-tightening restrictions mean for the country's economy. And a look into a mystery of the coronavirus numbers in Iran. But first, Henry has emailed more or less at bbc.co.uk to say,
I would love to hear from one of my heroes, David Spiegelhalter, on the topic of risk in the context of COVID. I think there is much to reassure us and common sense to impart.
Henry, your wish is our command. I spoke to David Spiegelhalter, the chair of the Winton Centre for Evidence and Risk Communication at Cambridge University, on Monday. He's been taking a close look at the data being used by the Imperial College London team who've been modelling the disease and advising the government. The numbers show that the proportion of people who get infected who go on to die increases with age. And David noticed that the trend matches almost exactly how our background mortality risk increases sharply with age. He plotted both lines on a graph and could scarcely believe what he saw.
I was amazed. They go right along the same curve.
So what I understand you're saying is that if you contract coronavirus, you've got the same risk of dying over the next couple of weeks as you would normally have of dying over the next year, no matter what your age is.
Yes, very roughly. And also, actually, not only just your age, but also your background health, because most of the deaths each year in normal life are from people who are already chronically ill. And similarly for coronavirus, that we know, we hear that the people who die often, you almost always have some accompanying health problems. And on the whole, though, the risks for very healthy people are a lot lower. And so I think it's quite remarkable. Yes, if you get the virus, it's like in the next couple of weeks, you're going to cram in a year's worth of background risk.
And this really struck me thinking about the societal impact, because for an individual, that doesn't sound too bad. And I think for a lot of people, it isn't too bad. If you're 95, you obviously recognize you might not live another year. If you're 35, you probably will live another year unless you're very unlucky. But from a social point of view, if one just imagines everybody in the country getting this disease at the same time, then you have the whole year's worth of deaths suddenly happening over the next couple of weeks. And just imagining what that would do to the hospitals, what that would do to the cemeteries, absolutely horrific.
And that's exactly what the Imperial Group found in their analysis. They said that if the virus was just allowed to let rip, we did absolutely nothing, then around 80% of people would get it and about 500,000 would die. And that means, essentially, if everyone got it, around 600,000 would die, which is a year's worth of deaths. So we would get, if everyone got the virus, we'd get a year's worth of deaths all at once, boom, like that. And so, you know, even anywhere near that is just going to be absurd in terms of the stresses on society. So that's why, you know, damping this down, suppressing it becomes absolutely vital, because although the risks for an individual are low, when you multiply them up over vast numbers of people, then the total impact on society becomes huge.
One thing that seems to be going around is, well, it's like the flu. I mean, just looking at flu and flu deaths, is it like the flu?
Well, no, it's about twice as infectious as the flu and about roughly 10 times as dangerous, perhaps. And in particular, you know, many people get very nasty respiratory conditions, which even if they survive could lead to long-term harm. So it's a nasty disease it can cause in some people, a small minority of people. But in the sense that one thing that people do forget, perhaps, which I think it is worth remembering, is that flu is, again, small risks for individual multiplied up over the country, it means it can be very nasty. So a good year of flu, around about 700 people might die in this country. Bad year, 13, 15,000 might die. Median, around about 6 to 8,000 people are dying a year of flu. So that's a lot. In fact, this year, it's been a very good year for flu, very low level. You know, we're currently running below average winter mortality in this country. There's only been 100 deaths in ICUs from flu since last October. I should say only, of course, these are serious affairs, very tragic, but it's actually much better than normal. So what this means is that the country can cope with and seems to be able to deal with 6 to 8,000 deaths a year of mainly elderly, vulnerable people from seasonal flu. And we may, if we're very lucky, and everyone suppresses this and keeps to the rules, keep COVID mortality down to that kind of level, you know, or maybe a bit more than that. But that's what it's hoping, that it might be, less than 20,000 or so.
And if we do, it's worth saying, that's not because COVID's no worse than flu. That's because we've gone to the most extraordinary measures to put the economy in a coma in order to make it 20,000 rather than 200,000 or 500,000.
Yeah, absolutely. It's only because of all these actions that we could keep it down to those levels. But it might mean then that if these activities are successful, even if we do get up to the level of hundreds of deaths a day, which we will, it might mean that overall, over the whole winter, our actual number of deaths might not be that much bigger than normal. It's quite a difficult, concept to talk about, I think, is that because the people who will succumb to COVID-19 are elderly and have other conditions, many of them actually are likely to have died fairly soon either, and the disease is bringing their deaths forward, and maybe by not a huge amount. So that means that overall, the deaths that are being allocated to COVID actually would normally have been allocated to another cause, a few months later on.
So are you saying that if everyone in the population got this disease, basically what we'd be doing is just bringing forward all the deaths we could expect over the next year, and it would just happen all at once, but overall the death rate would over the course of a year wouldn't really change?
Nope. No, this is crazy. Let's say if everyone got the virus all at once, you'd have 600,000 deaths, whatever. That would be an estimate, and that's how many die in a year. Now, it's not just the people who are going to die in the following year, and all the survivors then are just are bound to live for the following year. A lot of people will still die as well. There's a lot of new deaths from the COVID, of course. The degree of overlap is a matter of argument. In other words, how many people would have died anyway in the next year of the people who are now dying for COVID? And I'm not going to make a guess of what that is. But even if it were, say, let's say 50%, you'd still have 300,000 excess deaths in the year, and that is a massive, massive issue. Anyway, we just can't cope with that sort of event. It would just be too catastrophic for words. So, that's why things have got to be done.
I do still occasionally encounter people who say, I'm not scared of this virus. I'm not going to be beaten by the virus. I'm not afraid. I'm going to still go and see my friends. I'm going to hang out because, you can't let this thing get us down. Any thoughts?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't meet people like that, and I'm glad I don't, because I would get cross with them, because it's not an individual decision. This is not an individual about my risk is low. My risk is quite low, I think, but still, the point is, not my risk to me, it's my risk to the people around me. With infectious diseases, it's the community, it's the society, we're absolutely vital, and we all owe a duty to that. We do not want to export our maybe what be slightly low risk to other people who might have higher risk. And we know about how quickly people can infect others. If I've got the disease and I'm wandering around, I will on average infect like 2.5 people. And then each of those would infect 2.5 people, which would be an additional, 7 or so people. And each of those, there'll be an additional 15 or, I can't do the sum, 17 people. Anyway, it increases exponentially. And exponential increase is frightening because it just, hammers up the whole time. Our deaths so far in this disease have been increasing about 30% per day. Now, those figures are really frightening, because although we're doing deaths still in the tens, I did a rough calculation and it would lead to sort of 10,000 deaths a day by mid-April.
Professor Sir David Spiegelhalter, speaking to me on Monday. Thankfully, he says the numbers won't get that scary because we are taking measures to stay away from each other to slow the spread of the disease. Loyal listener Rich Knight has been in touch with the programme. Other particularly loyal listeners may remember Rich as a one-time producer of the show, indeed a statistical colossus who bestrode more or less for several series. He is now one of our overlords at Radio 4, and he turned to us after watching a particularly unsettling item on the news. Unsettling, that is, if, like me, you think of yourself as too young to be at risk of any really dangerous consequences.
I've been wondering if we as a family have been taking the health threat seriously enough. I heard somebody from the US say, I think, that 40% of hospitalisations were people aged 20 to 50. Not really what we were told at the start. Maybe more or less could dig into that one. There's so little clarity about what we really know.
Ruth Alexander's been busy with her statistical spade and she joins us from the relative safety of her living room. Hello, Ruth. Hope you've been keeping safe.
It does feel very safe, actually. Thanks, Tim. I'm also, as an extra precaution, under a duvet right now. I suppose that's partly something to do with trying to record with decent sound quality, but, you know, it's kind of comforting as well.
That's the way things are. So what do you make of Rich's question?
The numbers that Rich is referring to came from a report from the US Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC for short. It's an early release of data about cases of COVID-19 reported in the US in a little over a month, from the 12th of February to March the 16th. Now, the first thing to say is that a lot of information is missing because this is only preliminary data. So there were more than 4,000 cases reported, but they only know the age for just over half of those patients, and they don't know precisely what's happened to all of them. So the data is a little fuzzy.
OK, so with those massive caveats noted, what do we know?
Well, we know that 508 of the patients definitely went to hospital, and 38% of those were between the ages of 20 and 54. So not quite the 40% of 20 to 50-year-olds stat that Rich contacted us about. But I think it's worth breaking those figures down a little further. 20% of those who we know were hospitalised were aged 20 to 44, and 18% were aged 45 to 54.
I notice, I mean, it's a small thing, but it's worth highlighting. Those two age groups, they're quite different in size. So 20 to 44, that's 25 years. And then 45 to 54, that's just a decade.
Yes, the 20 to 44 age group is larger than actually all the older age groupings in this study.
So on a per capita basis, the risk is lower than it might at first seem for people aged 20 to 44.
Yes, but meanwhile, let's remember, we're only looking at 508 patients who we know were hospitalised, so these figures are far from robust numbers. But nonetheless, the CDC has also tried to estimate the chance of someone in each age group being hospitalised. They've expressed it as a range to reflect the uncertainty of the figures. And to keep it simple, I've taken the middle of the range. And so then we can see that the 20 to 44-year-olds with COVID-19 had around an 18% chance of hospitalisation, but only a 3% chance of ending up in an intensive care unit. And the chance of death was about 1 in 1,000. For 45 to 54-year-olds, these numbers were a bit higher. And patchy as these statistics are, we have seen some data for England, Wales and Northern Ireland intensive care units, which do seem to back up these trends.
So the data are incomplete, but they give us a glimpse of how COVID-19 might be affecting different age groups. And that glimpse shows us it can be serious for younger adults.
It can. The CDC had no data whatsoever on underlying conditions, though. Its report also makes clear that the risk of serious illness in COVID-19 patients increases with age. Older people are the worst affected, as data from China and elsewhere in the world has already been showing. And we have to remember, looking at these numbers, that they're not taking into account the large number of mild cases, because mild cases are generally not reported. If they were, the chance of young adults being hospitalised would look much lower.
Thank you, Ruth. You are listening to More or Less. And if you'd like more statistical shenanigans, you can find our podcast on BBC Sounds. And if you, like Rich Knight, have a question for us, you can email moreorless@bbc.co.uk. Now, speaking of young people getting coronavirus, in a moment I'm going to play you an item about coronavirus in Iran. It was produced and presented by Jordan Dunbar, but since he made this piece, Jordan himself has been taken ill. Jordan, can you hear me?
I can, Tim.
I feel so sorry for you. How you have the virus, you think? How are you feeling?
I haven't worn socks in a week because I've just been too hot. I have been to Mordor and back, frankly, Tim. But I feel like I'm coming at the other side of it now.
Yeah, but it was bad.
It was very bad, yeah.
Oh, well, I'm glad you're feeling a little bit better. It's very kind of you to join us to introduce your own piece. Let me play you in, Jordan. Across the world, different countries are releasing statistics about the number of coronavirus cases they've been facing. But can we trust these figures, particularly when they come from more secretive regimes, such as Iran, with a history of misrepresenting important things? For example, only in January, they lied about having mistakenly shot down a Ukrainian passenger plane. Well, Jordan Dunbar has been looking into this. Jordan, are you ready to introduce the piece?
I am.
Go for it.
This is Ashley Tsud. She's from the University of Toronto, where she studies infectious diseases. She had a hunch that there was something not quite right about these figures coming out of Iran.
I believe it was February 19th when Iran reported their first cases of coronavirus, and the two cases that they reported were actually deaths. That is an alarming sign because typically when you have a disease spreading in your population, it's going to take a bit of time for that infection to develop. So a person becomes infected, then they become sick. And then we know that the average time from infection onset to death is a couple of weeks. So if you have two deaths in your population without having previously reported any cases, that suggests that the disease has been circulating for several weeks at the very least. And then the next day after Iran reported those first cases, we in Canada had a case. It was the first case that was diagnosed in a person who had returned from a place other than China. And this person had had a history of travel to Iran. And so, you know, we're talking about an outbreak in Iran where to date we only have two reported cases. And then the next case that we know of is in a returning traveler.
Thinking that was unlikely, Ashley Tsud analysed the coronavirus found in those returning from Iran and worked backwards, extrapolating that to the country's population.
What we found was our intuition was right. We estimated the actual outbreak size was probably around 18,500 cases in Iran. It was about 500-fold greater than what was being reported in Iran at the time. And, you know, when I first ran those numbers, I thought, you know, I had done something wrong because I was expecting that there would be a large outbreak there. I wasn't expecting such a large size. But the reason that we were estimating such a large outbreak is that the countries that were reporting these exported cases don't really have large travel volumes. So Canada, for an example, compared to other countries, is 31st in terms of the number of passengers that leave Iran to come to Canada every month. So when you do these calculations, you end up with a pretty big outbreak size in Iran.
Other academics have also started to question Iran's statistics. Graham Wood is a lecturer in political science at Yale University in the United States.
The first time I became suspicious was when I saw the name of Masoumeh Ebtekar, who is one of the vice presidents of the country. Her name is one of the names of perhaps half a dozen Iranian politicians who I could just name off the top of my head. She's famous. And I wondered, what are the odds that one of the, at that point, just a few hundred cases, is a case of someone whose name I already know, given how few names of prominent Iranians I know? And so I started running the numbers then.
And when you say running the numbers, what did you actually do to try and work out what the odds were?
I did what's sometimes called back-of-the-envelope calculation, order-of-magnitude calculation. In other words, just trying to figure out what are the odds. If I figure that I know six politicians, and one, maybe two of them actually, with Sheikh al-Islam dying not too long after that, are dead, then you do a kind of count over proportion and see what that suggests about the broader population. And of course, those assumptions that I have the right number of politicians, that I know how many of them are sick, those are all a bit iffy. What I was trying to figure out was, just as a kind of gut check, what the true numbers might be.
An order of magnitude estimation is not that precise. Graham Wood was wondering whether there were tens of cases, hundreds of cases, thousands of cases. Each is an order of magnitude higher with an extra zero at the end. If Graham knew the names of less than 10 politicians in Iran and two of them had the virus, that suggested a big proportion of the population might have it. But maybe the virus was concentrated on politicians and they'd all cut it off each other. So Graham looked for other evidence, like Ashley Toot's research and testing done on a group of Chinese people living in Iran who were tested when they returned to China.
I approached this from seven different angles. A very important thing here is to try to find approximations and assumptions whose biases or whose sources of error are not correlated. That is, you could look at politicians, but you want to look at other things too, like how quickly are they filling up hospital beds, and what other things do we know about the structure of Iran that might suggest numbers. And the numbers that I got were a couple orders of magnitude greater than the ones that were being admitted. That is to say, Iran at the time was saying it had about 7,000 COVID cases, and it seemed more like they had numbers in the hundreds of thousands and possibly even millions.
Thanks to Ashley Toot, Graham Wood, and our own coronavirus reporter, Jordan Dunbar. Get well soon, Jordan. In the last few weeks, there's been further evidence coming out of Iran that suggests larger numbers of cases and deaths. Satellite photos have shown huge trenches being dug in the cemetery of the city at the centre of the Iranian outbreak. Even video from inside those cemeteries has got out. But Iran has still not imposed lockdowns. In the UK, of course, we are now almost at a complete lockdown. Bars, restaurants and cinemas are closed, the high streets are empty, no one's planning on taking a holiday anytime soon, and all of this has to have an impact on the economy. To find out how big an impact, on Monday, before restrictions were tightened even further, I spoke to Chris Giles, the economics editor of the Financial Times.
I think if nothing was done, we would have a sense that in terms of what's shut down, we're sort of in the 20 to 30% of the economy, not necessarily all of it entirely shut, but it's a very, very large proportion, and you're soon going to get a lot of construction shutting down and manufacturing as parts become difficult. So if this was normal, you'd think we're in the most almighty recession.
I mean, a regular recession might be, you know,
2 to 3%.
Yeah, and a really bad recession, 10%. But exactly. I mean, so we're talking 30%, maybe.
Yes, and we just have to hope it's a very short period, that it's a very, very steep, very, very deep, and we get out of it quickly. And that's the hope. I'm not necessarily sure it should be the expectation, but it is definitely the hope.
Yes. I mean, the extraordinary thing, of course, is that unlike a normal recession where you try and encourage people to get out and spend and hire, here we don't want people to go out and spend. We don't want people to hire. We actually want these parts of the economy put in a coma. So rather than just generally trying to stimulate the economy, what needs to be done, and what has the new Chancellor Rishi Sunak been doing?
Well, I think the word stimulus, is, as you suggest, is entirely wrong in this case. We might want to be using the phrase fiscal insurance, because what we're trying to do is to insure the economy, have a big payout, and then hopefully when it goes away, everyone is in a position just to start up again. So the specific policy is that the government will reimburse employees up to 80% of their former salary, up to £2,500 a month. And the idea is to keep them employed rather than being made redundant by their companies, so that when things start up again, they can go back to life almost as normal.
Obviously, there are many other measures and there may be further measures coming. What's the sense among the economics community about whether Mr. Sunak has done the right thing, whether he's done enough, whether he's on the right lines?
The sense is at the moment that he has done the right thing. The Treasury's been very fast in recognising that the initial policy, which seemed big on Budget Day, of essentially some stopgap measures, isn't enough, and now we need to go for a really very large social insurance programme, building one essentially overnight. What the aim of policy here is to mean that people don't get fired. We really, really don't want companies to go bust, and we don't want people to be made unemployed, because then the scarring of this episode will last much, much longer. We know that it's going to be horribly expensive. This is something that we can worry about later, because if we don't do it, then we'll still have to worry about that, because we're going to have a huge recession anyway, and the scarring would be much greater. So that's the general thought process here.
We've had 10 years of austerity, haven't we? I mean, I thought the budget was under pressure and it was all very difficult to fund everything. How can we afford this suddenly?
Well, we're going to afford this because we and our children and our grandchildren will pay for this in the years ahead, and we're going to borrow to do it. And if the markets won't lend to us as in Britain or any other country, I am sure this is not yet policy, but I'm sure the Bank of England will simply print the money so that the money is created to fund it. And then over time, we work out how we fund it. You know, let's be brutal and frank about this. This does mean almost certainly higher taxes in future. It's not the thing we need to think about now, but there's a whole question of what is fiscal sustainability, and we need to come back to that because we're going to rack up a very large amount of debt for this period. And that's the right thing to do, because if we don't do that, we'll probably rack up just as much, if not more, and grow out of it slower.
Chris, obviously we don't know how many companies will take up this offer, and we don't know how long the economy is going to be shut down. But do you have any idea how much this might cost?
Well, I think we know how much it costs, as it were, per person, roughly. So per million people who take it up, we think it costs about £3.5 billion for 3 months. So it could be 3 million people, it could be 10 million people. And then we also have to remember that tax revenues are going to fall off a cliff as well, because there's not a lot of normal activity happening. So we had a budget deficit which was in the ballpark of about £50 billion, rising to £60 billion a year for the UK. I would have thought this year we should be thinking at a minimum of about £150 billion, but we have really, at the moment, very little idea exactly how deep it is. But it's going to be putting us pretty much back where we were at the height of the financial crisis.
Chris Giles of the Financial Times speaking to me on Monday. And that is all we have time for. But if you have any questions about the numbers behind COVID-19, please email moreorless@bbc.co.uk. And not just the virus, we do plan to broaden our horizons over the coming programmes because, goodness knows, they're narrow enough right now. Ask us anything. Tricky maths questions from homeschool, that sort of thing. We will be back next week. And until then, goodbye.
More or Less was produced by Kate Lamble and edited by